My name is Mark Schwein, and this is a session entitled The Virtues of Teaching and Learning. Welcome, everyone. I know from talking to some of you as you've come in that it's not necessarily the case that you're here because you have a deep and abiding interest in the virtues of teaching and learning. In some cases, I know that you're here because it's the, as they say, only game in town. Teachers have to be realistic about the different motivations of those sitting in their midst before they begin to speak. What we've been doing, for those of you who have not attended any of these sessions earlier, and by the way, don't be uneasy, each session sort of self-contained, so you don't have to have been at earlier ones. But these sessions all deal, the ones I'm doing this week, with education, broadly considered, and with the relationship between education and spirituality. More exactly, the relationship between education and certain virtues that we would be disposed to call spiritual virtues, in that they arose, at least originally, within communities that were religious in some sense or another. So we've been really talking about the relationship between cognitive skills, the cultivation of the mind, and the cultivation of the spirit, and noticing, or trying to notice, what our culture has in large part forgotten, how totally interdependent the development of the mind and the development of the spirit really are. So that kind of gives you a broad framework. This one is entitled The Virtues of Teaching and Learning, and I had frankly originally entitled the session The Teaching of Virtue and the Virtue of Teaching, but that turned out to have too many letters in it. It wouldn't fit on the tape or up there, so I had to sort of condense it. For those of you who don't know, I'm Mark Schwein. I'm currently the dean of an honors college and do quite a bit of teaching, have done quite a bit of it in a lot of different contexts over the past 25 years, and so I've spent a lot of my life, as I know many of you have, thinking about teaching and learning, and want in the course of the hour we have before us to set out some ideas and then invite your conversation and thoughtful responses to those ideas. And I thought I would begin tonight with really four little stories and then reflect on those stories by way of some comments on the relationship between virtue or character and pedagogy or teaching. Story number one is just really a little quote that I'm going to read you from one of the dialogues of Plato, written millennia ago. And it's a very short quote. It's simply the beginning of one of the Platonic dialogues. A character comes up to Socrates and says, and the character's name is Meno. He says, "Can you tell me, Socrates, whether virtue is acquired by teaching or by practice? Or if neither by teaching nor practice, then whether it comes to a human being by nature, or in what other way?" I read that because I think it's fair to say that the question of whether or not virtue, good character, can be taught is perhaps one of the oldest, maybe the oldest question in Western philosophical thinking. And you know, all of you, if we make this a little less abstract and a little more concrete, how vital a question that is. How many times haven't you wondered if your parents, how it comes to pass that so-and-so's, this group of youngsters have apparently very good parents, but they behave like barbarians. And other children whose parenting you know to be not as careful seem to grow up saints. You, in other words, struggle with just exactly how it is that human beings become excellent, how it is that they become the sort of people that you would admire or that I would admire. Is it because they take some sort of pill? Is it because of the church they belong to? Is it because of the school they've attended? Is it because of the parenting they've received? It's the same question Mino's asking here. Or another theory, well, she was just born an angel. He was just born an angel, and seemed that way from the moment he or she emerged from the womb. So people still are baffled, even today, it seems fair to say, after centuries of reflection on this subject, of how it is that you wind up creating, shaping, forming human beings that are excellent. Okay, that's story number one. Story number two. How many of you in here have seen the film Stand and Deliver? One, two, three, four, five. Okay, good. So I have some helpers on telling this story. So feel free to supplement. This is a film, Stand and Deliver, based on an account by the central character in the film named Jaime Escalante, who was a man who came up from South America, settled in Los Angeles, and wound up teaching mathematics in high school that was in really the Los Angeles inner city, so to speak. Hispanic youth, many of them from home situations that were very difficult. And this man became an extraordinary teacher, and so extraordinary that he quickly introduced calculus instead of just elementary algebra and so forth, started calculus. His colleagues thought this was absurd to be teaching calculus to high school students, especially those high school students. And then eventually, the class that he teaches in calculus winds up collectively scoring higher than any other class in the United States on the calculus examination. ETS, Educational Testing Service, based in Princeton, gets these results and looks at this high school and says, this is fraudulent, this couldn't have happened. And after quite a lot of commotion, they finally agree to retake the exam and do equally as well. The interesting part of the story is that what you learn is that the learning of mathematics, in this case calculus, for this community, depended as much on these students learning to trust one another and themselves and the teacher for them to become responsible to one another and to the teacher and to the subject. In other words, my point is, they learned mathematics, in this case calculus, well and deeply as a group, not just because one had before them somebody who knew a lot about mathematics, but who knew a lot about human beings and who cared deeply for them. In other words, the point is that it was in the course of shaping this into a community of inquiry, of caring people who held each other accountable, that they learned the math so well. Okay? Story number three, not unlike this one, mathematician, brilliant mathematician at Berkeley, decided to head up the an extremely complicated operation of calculus at the university level at Berkeley, and became quickly puzzled by the fact that black students, as a group, though their tests, aptitude tests, were extremely high, and all the kind of tests they could give them on motivation were extremely high, did poorer as a group in the calculus sequence than did, say, Asian students or other groups of students, defined whichever way they were defined. And he became perplexed by this. And after going through the standard liberal and conservative accounts for why this might be the case, the structure of the home, from which these students came, the emphasis on mathematics and the rewards given for intellectual achievement, on and on. None of these seemed to work to account for this difference. And so he took it upon himself, this brilliant mathematician, to simply follow some of these students around and see how they spent a week preparing for their classes, and in particular for calculus. Found that they spent, on the average, a time and again, if not twice as much time as, say, the Asian students or other randomly selected students. So it wasn't a question that they weren't working. What was distinct is that for some reason they had the notion that when they did their homework, they had to do it alone. They believed that it was not ethical, not proper, not whatever, for them to work together. Asian students worked together continually, checked each other's homework and so forth. And so this guy said, all right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, says to this group of students. I want you to promise me that you will study only half as much as you normally do. Two, I want you to all promise to study with someone else. And three, when you turn in your homework, you must turn in with it a sheet signed by another student indicating that that student has checked your homework. That's all you've got to do. Study half the time, study with at least one other person, turn in a sheet showing that someone else has checked your homework. Fine, they did this. And at the end of the year, that group of students, these three simple things, put them now 2 percentage points above any other group of the students at Berkeley in calculus and mathematics. Again, the point is, here you have somebody who arranges a situation in which, by virtue of working together, and by the way, these people were tested, of course, separately. I mean, when they got the calculus exams, they had to take these exams and score just like anybody else. So the fact that they worked with each other on the homework, all that that meant was the cultivation of relying on one another, learning from one another, a kind of interpersonal and intersubjective community this guy created by these little simple devices, helped them to learn calculus better. That's story three. And story four is a personal one. The first thing I read was a quote from a philosopher. I've told you two stories about mathematics. I'll tell you a little bit about the kind of writing and thinking I do. I'm a historian. And I tend to work on single individuals and their lives and their thoughts, people like William James, for instance, and find recurrently that as I write, and as my peers read what I write, they will often use terms like, oh, it doesn't seem to me that you've been here fair enough to James in making this judgment, or it doesn't seem to me that you've shown enough charity in understanding the relationship between William James's ideas and the quality of his marriage at a certain point, so forth and so on. In other words, very quickly in the critical appraisal of my work, certain moral terms get introduced, fairness, charity, etc. And moreover, my major mentor at Stanford when I was in graduate school once said to me, Schwein, a historian's no damn good until he's 40. It seemed to be kind of an arbitrary and bizarre thing to say. It was actually a liberating thing to say because until I turned 40, I always had an excuse for not amounting to much. Now that I'm over 40, it's a little more tricky. And I thought about that for a long time. At first I thought that this was just a kind of an arbitrary pronouncement by a college professor. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that in this area of history and in a number of other areas where there's a high premium placed on understanding the lives and the thoughts of other human beings, it's just true that you have to be alive and about in the world for a while. You have to kind of grow up yourself. You have to kind of learn. You have to sort of have your own character shaped fairly firmly and fairly well in order to begin to appraise fairly and completely and judiciously the lives and thoughts of others. And so, I mean, I think there's something to that, and it helps explain also why historians, literary critics, philosophers tend to mature very late, and why mathematicians and others tend to mature very early. That is, the more the subject matter requires an understanding of other human beings, the more the later in one's life does one develop fully as a thinker. Okay, so those are the four stories. Now, what to make of them? Let me give you this thesis. This thesis, and I'll refer back to the stories, is the following: that at least when it comes to higher education, it's a fact that for most of Western history, higher learning went on in communities that were religious in character. This includes the Platonic Academy now, which most people don't realize was a gathering place for sacrifice and for religious ceremonies before Plato and others got started in talking about ideas. And that somehow the rise of the modern research university, which is only about 100 years old, took place at about the same time that a process of secularization did. And so what has happened, in effect, is that though learning was dependent for centuries, even millennia, on the practice of certain virtues like charity and faith and friendship in the sense of both philia and agape, that sense of character and virtue has gradually attenuated because the kind of religious underpinnings for much of higher learning have withered away. And so what we have is a lot of highly powerful methodological procedures, technical procedures for learning stuff, but a lot of the moral underpinnings have sort of withered away, and we've forgotten how integrally related the spiritual and the mental really are. And now what I want to do is to really give you three brief illustrations before we start talking together of how this is so. I want to take three virtues and show you how it is that I think those virtues are essential to learning and to teaching. And if you don't have them, you're apt not to learn, you're apt not to teach very well. And number one is the virtue of humility. Not a virtue that comes out of the Enlightenment. My students, about a month before I came, I always have them read the Confessions of St. Augustine, and we always work on a passage in the Confessions of St. Augustine, a beautiful passage in which he talks about the loss of his friend and what that meant to him. Friend dies suddenly. And there's this wonderful passage on loss and on friendship, really quite moving. My students come to class, we start to open up the passage. It's as though I'm speaking to stones here. I know them well, I care for them, know that they care deeply about friendship, know that some of them have known loss, am perplexed. Why is it that nothing's happening? Well, I tend always to fault myself in cases like this, as I think most reasonably responsible teachers do. I thought perhaps I hadn't really sufficiently introduced the text or the materials, but I had in this case. I knew that. I went through the normal standard. Was this spring weekend? What was going on? Well, as we began to talk about this, a few of the students made kind of glib remarks about how they just thought that this passage on friendship and loss was too obscure. Others thought that Augustine was just wrong about this. They weren't resonating, so. Well, as we talked about this, because we then turned the class into a conversation about why it was that this particular passage by Augustine on subjects they cared for wasn't getting anywhere, and it turned out that they were just way too hasty in their dismissal of the stuff. They thought that Augustine was just wrong and inconsistent in what he'd said there. And I suddenly realized that a difference between me and them, and between, I think, a lot of the people in my generation and them, was that whenever I read a text, and this is still true of me, whenever I read something, I always presume that the author is wiser than I am. I mean, so I presume that if I don't get straight something, or if Augustine or Plato or Tolstoy or some contemporary writer just seems inconsistent, that the problem must be mine, not the author's. This is at least my initial operating assumption. It's not necessarily the bottom line. And so when I see something that looks just silly, I think, well, you know, Augustine, I can say silly things. I can't imagine that Augustine's saying silly things. And so I try to work at this to see exactly what's being said in such a way that it then adds up to something where I learn from it. So I'm not trotting out before you my humility, because of course this would be a kind of paradox to be proud about being humble. The point is that I think that young people today, many people today, don't have that kind of presumption of wisdom in the text or in the material or in the other, and then aren't charitable enough to try to put the best construction on everything, as Luther said we ought to in explaining the Eighth Commandment, and therefore are too easily dismissive of what it is they read or see or think about. They dismiss it in a peremptory way. My notion is you owe the other, in humility, the benefit of the doubt, and then finally down the line, you can be justified in saying, well, in this case, he or she simply was mistaken, was inconsistent, was murky, was needlessly obscure, etc. So my notion here is that the virtue of humility which Luther describes, has a wonderful passage on it in his commentary on the Magnificat, as the one virtue that can't look at itself in the mirror. Humility pictured as an individual and as the virtue as embodied, and if it once catches sight of itself, it's no longer humility. You follow me? In other words, it's kind of like humility has to be so unself-conscious, otherwise it turns into being proud about being humble, and therefore it's no longer humility. But in any event, it seems to me that that kind of disposition, the disposition of humility, a deeply religiously grounded virtue, is essential to authentically learning and authentically teaching. How does one as a teacher then instill, begin to form in the souls of the young the virtue of humility? That's a tough question. Not, it seems to me, by humiliating them, which some teachers do. They think that you can make someone humble by humiliating them. That just does not work. That, it seems to me, is to put the teacher in a position of being arrogant. What does work, it seems to me, is for teachers to say the hardest three words for all teachers a little more regularly. Those three words being, I don't know. When I was in graduate school and one of my teachers finally said, I don't know, I nearly fell onto the floor. I mean, I realized I'd been in school for I don't know how many years and I had never heard a professor say those three words. And I realized, as a teacher, it's very hard for me to do that. It's easier now than it was 10 years ago when I was a little insecure myself and thought I had to maintain a kind of presence in the classroom and credibility, and so was a kind of master at all of those evasive tactics to conceal my own ignorance from my students. Like, well, that's really a very good question. Rather than me answering it, I think perhaps we should use it as a general... I knew all of these gambits and practiced them very well, but never said, I don't know. Now, it seems to me, had I said that more often, that begins then to let people do what's absolutely fundamental to learning, which is to admit their own ignorance. If they're not willing to admit their ignorance, that's what Socrates would say, they can learn nothing. They think they already know what motive is there for opening themselves up to learn something. So whether you talk about humility as the Christian virtue or what Socrates said, the only thing I know is that I don't know, it seems to me, again, absent that virtue, learning can't take place in any deep and authentic way. Thus the link between spiritual communities and higher learning. Integral connection. Okay? Let's take another virtue, and then I'll open this up. A couple more virtues. The next one is, and this is a tough one, self-denial. Self-denial. What do we mean by this? We mean by this the notion that conversation with others about important matters that arises when we consider together texts, whether they're the scriptures or great works of literature or a film we've seen or whatever, always entails a great amount of risk, because to some degree, when we get to important matters, we to some degree are our own opinions. That is to say, part of what defines who we are as human beings is the opinions that we hold. So to offer one of them out in public, to say, here's what I think about X, in a serious, authentic way, and then to be willing to give it up if it turns out that someone else has a stronger argument or someone else has some points or information that you were ignorant of. There are many, many grounds on which one ought to change one's opinion. If it's a wrong opinion, one ought to change it. And it seems to me to the capacity to change opinion that are deeply held requires a certain amount of self-denial. You have to actually risk a part of yourself for the sake of the truth if you're serious about learning. Now, my students often interpret this to mean that they have to desperately learn to win every argument. They turn this into a kind of contest. They learn to argue, and by the sophomore year, they are sophomores, with all that that means. They wind up with a kind of one sophomore, one vote version of the truth. Well, this is my opinion, this is yours, and we all have opinions, and there we are. And they also get good at arguing, where they think the important thing about argument is to win. Now, it seems to me that that's a mistake. It seems to me important to argue. It seems to me important to have conflict. It seems to me important that you be able to defend your ideas. Don't misunderstand me. But if you have the virtue of self-denial, what can happen to you is what Pico della Mirandola, who was a Renaissance philosopher, said. I thought this a brilliant quotation. He said, "In intellectual conversation, it is always a gain to lose." He loved intellectual conversation because he said, there you always win by losing. If, in other words, your opinion in the conversation is the same afterwards as it was beforehand, what have you gained? If, on the other hand, you learn that you were mistaken, and you have the wisdom to know when to abandon opinions and when not to, and you've lost the argument, you come away richer because you now have the truth, or at least you're closer to it than you were before the conversation started. So in real intellectual conversation, in communities of inquiry sustained by spiritual virtues, it is a gain to lose. And this comes very close, some of you who know your New Testament, when Jesus says, if ye continue in my word, ye are my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, and then also the great passage about finding your life by losing it, and so forth. In other words, there's a certain kind of sense in which we must be prepared to deny ourselves for the sake of the truth, with a capital T or a small t, otherwise we simply have no chance of finding it out. Thus, the virtue of self-denial, again, it seems to me, is essential to learning. One more, and then I'll stop. It seems to me that in the classroom, the greatest of these is charity, as it is in life in general. Caritas. And I've already alluded to it a bit in talking about the first of the virtues, humility. Caritas, charity, it seems to me, involves, at least in the context of learning, the disposition to treat other human beings, whether they're before you, as you are before me now, and you are before one another now, or whether they're present in their writings, in their words, in something that they've made that you're looking at on the screen. It seems to me that we are best if we are disposed to treat those words, thoughts, ideas charitably. That is, putting the best construction on them. Going the second mile before we reject, scoff at, dismiss, etc. Now don't misunderstand me. At a certain point, the loving thing to do might be a very rigorous and pointed critique of what the person has said. But before that rigorous and pointed critique is voiced, it seems to me a charitable relationship has to be established, because otherwise the critique won't be heard. Otherwise the person will simply retreat, walk in the opposite direction, and you will not have made a friend or taught someone something. You will have simply created a kind of separation between two people, hardened in their own opinions, with neither one of you having the possibility of testing your opinion and finding out which is the true one. There's a saying that wherever there are two faculty members gathered together, there are always three opinions, each of theirs and the right one. the point being that if you don't treat one another thoughtfully and charitably, the chances of either of you learning from the other are reduced. Okay? I think that's all I'm going to say. Before we open it up, I just remind you to reflect simply on the kinds of things that go on at Holden Village, which can be a very challenging place for all of us, because the village in its programming is extremely thoughtful in setting before the villagers a number of subjects, topics, people that tend to challenge only because it also has the Vespers going on. It has a kind of entire atmosphere where people can find the courage to be themselves and state what they think, but also find the courage beyond that to risk themselves and abandon what they think if that's what seems wise and warranted by virtue of what other peoples have testified, said, and shown. It can be tough. Some of you, I'm sure, whether it's this week or whether it's another time you've been at Holden, and certainly I am no exception to this myself, have felt yourself deeply unsettled by something you've heard a guest say or something you've heard in a presentation like this one, whatever. And in some ways, being unsettled just shows how deeply invested you are, as you should be, in what you think and care for. But it can also be being unsettled if you're open to the possibilities that you could be mistaken about this or that, a chance to win by losing. A chance, that is, to win more of the truth by losing an opinion that was mistaken. So it seems to me, again, that you have in this community a perfect illustration in sort of the texture of daily life of just exactly what I've been attempting to describe here in more abstract ways. Now I promise I'm going to stop, shut up, and invite you to comment. I've seen from your faces that some of you have some things you'd like to say, so please do. Questions, comments?
I'm interested in that example you gave about the kids learning mathematics by studying together. It's, I guess, not being an expert on education, that is not something I expected to hear. Has this been borne out in other studies, or is this something beyond a specific statement you made?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is written up in the Journal of I think it's the Journal of Negro Education, 1990, August issue, that whole study that Teichman did. Because what happened in his case was that all of the standard stuff in the literature as to why there should be this difference in performance, he tried and they just didn't work. They didn't explain. And he literally followed them around. And logged the number of hours they studied and watched their study patterns and so forth. And I mean, that study seems to me works not just for groups of black students, but groups of any number of students, because I find continually...
And in subjects other than mathematics.
And in subjects other than mathematics. My students, I find when I give them collaborative projects, which I do now all the time, I'll give eight of them, I'll divide the class into two groups, eight and eight, give them a common historical archive, ask them to write a narrative, each of them, without consulting the other team, explaining something. Why did Kinsey Hall burn down in May of 1970? That's our administration building. They have a historical archive. They come up, the eight of them, write this up. Of course, they're shocked to find that though they work with the same archive, the two stories are entirely different. They're shocked by this. And that's something I want to teach them, that history is interpretative. But then, individually, they write critiques of the opposite team's history. Everybody on Team A writes a critique of Team B's history, and everybody on Team B writes a critique of Team A's history. The point being that they hold each other to higher standards than even I would. When they're on that team of eight, and by George, this person had better deliver the data on the archive and the personal interviews and the oral history bank, and they hold each other accountable very well, and it turns out that those histories are superb pieces of work. I have some of my colleagues come in, we do simulated professional association meetings on them, and I want to tell you, they are much better than if I'd have asked each one of the 16 individually to go off and write a history there, that kind of collaborative energy. Now, I still have in the testing both an appraisal of the group endeavor, I get reports from the team captains, but also, of course, the individual critique they've done of the opposite team's history. So there's a kind of rhythm, a balance between individual achievement and corporate endeavor, but it seems to me that in my experience and in those of the my colleagues in the college where I teach, that's just always true, that the collaborative stuff really gets people to learn more rapidly and, by the way, with greater pleasure. They take greater pleasure in it. when it's not such a solitary and isolated experience. It's actually fun for them. I mean, these kids will stay up the last week that paper's due till 4 a.m. the last three nights and enjoy it. They don't realize it's 4 a.m. because they're going to get this right and rigorous, which is what I hope they can do. Yes?
Those kind of findings have been around really for quite some time. Student of small group communication. In the 60s, you know, we knew that we had an N factor, some, or we gave it to something. When you get a group of people together, something emerges that's more than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
And currently, you know, like in our family, we have children in middle school, and cooperative learning is somewhat of a controversial topic because while we've seen some real values to it and we support it, and it was for everyone.
It may not be for everyone.
There are many parents who are friends of ours who rebel against it and don't want their children in cooperative learning. For those of you who have experienced it, basically, in a primary level, what Mark has been talking about, where students work together, and it's not just individual achievement. My point bringing this up is that I think that I'm raising a question. Our society, I think, is individuals.
Right.
Some of us, we resist that notion, even though we've seen in a lot of cases it yields some superior results. I mean, I was writing back with a colleague from a meeting. He was complaining about his supervisor because she always has these participative things. You know, we all have to get. He just assumed, you know, be the loner. You know, give me my assignment, let me go. And although as a working society, we hear all the things about having to work with people, diversity, and do all these things together. I think, isn't there within a lot of people?
Absolutely.
Feeling like, I don't want to do that. You know, I want to be my own person. And, you know, forget this cooperative stuff.
No, that's quite right. Individualism is a deeply ingrained virtue or characteristic of American culture. And, I mean, you know, one can hardly gainsay it entirely because there's much about it that one wants to admire. I think when it comes to learning, that it's largely mythological that great work gets done by people working utterly in isolation from one another. At minimal, the language that you use and the tradition that you inhabit was created by a community, even if you're not sitting in the midst of it. I mean, in other words, no one is a great innovator unless he or she is, and this goes from jazz musicians all the way through to physicists, all the way through to you name it. And so there's always a corporate endeavor, even if it's not visible in three or four people sitting into a room thrashing it out. I saw so far only because I stood on the shoulders of giants, is what Newton says, and Darwin says, quoting Newton. And so, and most of the students are shocked. We serve them ill by not getting them into collaborative learning early, because when they get out there, whether it's in the business world or whether it's in a group of physicists renting some time at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and find continually people are working in collaboration. And if they haven't been able to do that from early on, even in the narrow sense of the word of success, they'll be set back, it seems to me. I'm not so interested in it as a kind of justifying it on the basis of that's the way it is in the world, as that's the way it seems to me that human souls flourish. In cooperation with one another. And that's the way the best learning takes place. I mean, I always tell my students, and I said this to some of you who were here last, they're going to learn more from each other in college than they're ever going to learn from me. My job as a dean is just to kind of create a community in which that can happen. Yes, you had a question or a comment, or somebody get over here. Yes.
Well, a couple of things now, if I can recall them. One of them is my making a mistake sometimes is one of the best things that can happen for my classroom. Because then I can be talked with, and I am not held above their heads. And especially when they catch my mistake and I admit that it was a mistake, and that it there will probably be a lot more mistakes showing up. Then they will kind of watch for them. And it makes me more human. And they are more willing to discuss with me, to ask questions, to grow and to trust me when they see a more human side. Also, the other thing I was going to comment about cooperative grouping, I just think it's real essential to learn to speak your opinion. And when we speak our opinion, it changes and it's reformed by hearing others' opinions. And if you're working alone, you don't have a chance to speak your opinion to somebody or to hear them speak their opinion. And I think it's, we've talked about some of the virtues, but I think communication, better communication skills come out of giving the children an opportunity for cooperative grouping, even though some of them really don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, sometimes they're so quick to catch the slow learners or the kids who don't understand, they're quicker to catch it than I am,
mm-hmm.
and they're willing to help them.
Mm-hmm. I think that your first observation brings up an important corrective, really, to what I said. Because one could argue that students, and here one just has to make that kind of judgment call that comes from experience. You have to figure out whether your students' major problem is that they tend to be too distrusting, that is, that they don't believe anything they read or they don't take the time with it, or too trusting. And you can err in either direction. Most people would say that the major intellectual virtue is skepticism, that is, not trusting anything, and being especially distrustful of authority. And sometimes, it seems to me, historically, that's been right. And you need to teach them that you are fallible, by being fallible in front of them. Or you need to show them how certain of the oracles that they just kind of think is the word from on high are mistaken. I give my students a paragraph in this very assignment of the joint history written up by our own faculty, which was the official faculty report on the Kinsey Hall fire, that is, it contains a paragraph that has three factual errors. And I give them an assignment to study the paragraph and explain why the faculty would have written that and so on. None of them bothered to check whether or not this is factually correct. And this happens all the time. They come in and this and that. We have this whole discussion. I said, well, the one thing you've overlooked is that the faculty here is totally wrong. What? Well, they say that the Cambodian invasion took place on such and such a date. They're actually a week off on that. No. They say that the band concert took place on Sunday. It actually took place on Tuesday. Did any of you check this? Well, no, because we thought the fact, well, they made a mistake here. Then the next most important question is, why would they have been so careless about those dates? I mean, you know, once we see that they made a mistake, then the question is, why would this group of careful people have been careless about that information? And then that gets us in more to the whole historical sense of the period. But my point is that you're making a mistake in front of them is teaching them not automatically to trust authority, and that's a good thing, provided that it's not carried over to the extreme where anytime you get a statement, you begin to presume, you're presumptuous now, that you know more than the person who is, you know, sharing the information with you. And it's a delicate
balance. In other words, you don't want to make too many mistakes.
Precisely. Because otherwise you just don't seem worth listening to, you know? Yeah. That's right.
But students do love that. And in a way, it's one of the classes I taught was advanced algebra. And I taught it the first hour of the day. So there were days when I wasn't quite awake and I'd write the wrong formula on the board. And they were so proud when they could catch that. I mean, that was so exciting to them that I could maybe be wrong sometimes, and it kept them attentive too, because then I just tell them, I say, I do make mistakes, make sure you correct me, and so then they'd follow even more closely. And
that's right.
It was a way to pull them in, so they felt they had some authority or some control in their own education.
Exactly.
They follow along. And
they feel like they're helping you now. You say,
oh, yes,
watch me, because I'm going to need your help, and so they feel like they're a fully licensed partner in this whole process. Mm-hmm. Which they don't feel enfranchised if they just look at you as a kind of flawless authority. Yes?
I'd like to even carry that down to even another level. is I've been through my teaching myself, but I find sometimes I have a hard time admitting my mistakes to my own boys. You know, they're only 5 and a half and 7. Sometimes it's hard for me to tell them that I made a mistake than it is to tell a group of medical students or something, you know, that I made a mistake. And that's, it's kind of strange, but for me, that's the way it is. And so I have to be honest with my boys. You know, I am honest there in my family and with my wife too. Then it seems to be easier when I move it out.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yes?
You mentioned that up until 100 years ago or so, a lot of higher education was religious based, and therefore these virtues probably existed in the institutions. What about present day religious higher education? Do you find that, you think that the education process works better because of that?
Well, I teach at a church-related school. I think that really church-related colleges and universities ought now to be less apologetic and more forceful in articulating and stipulating precisely what it is that makes those communities places where learning can flourish in a way that it can't in places that have forgotten the traditions and rituals and practices that sustain the virtues that I've been mentioning. So, I mean, that's my basic view. The difficulty, frankly, is that the modern research university does many wonderful things. I mean, I went to them myself and taught at one. So I have a decidedly mixed appraisal of them. But the problem is most people teaching at church-related schools will get their PhDs at institutions in which they're formed by the ethos of the major research universities. In other words, my concern is that lots of folks who go off with a sense of vocation, that they would really not flourish authentically if they weren't at a St. Olaf or a PLU or a Luther or a Notre Dame or one could go on, a Calvin, find that something happens to them in the 6 years they're at Berkeley or Stanford or Michigan or University of Illinois, etc. It's not just that they're learning chemistry, physics, and medicine there. It's that they themselves are being formed into a kind of ethos that shapes their own sense of calling and vocation in a way that's oftentimes very different from what it was when they entered. And any powerful professional program, medical school, law school, the academic world, any professional program is almost more powerful in shaping an ethos than it is in transmitting a tradition, an intellectual tradition and a body of skills. I mean, that's why, you know, you get the first day of law school, you people are going to come out here thinking like lawyers. And by George, they do. And lawyers think in a way that's different from the way engineers and medical doctors think, and that's fine. But the point is, along with that whole mode of thinking is an ethos, an ethic. It's not just as though people have been able to put their ethics on hold and been taught to think like lawyers, and they come out now having the same ethic but thinking like lawyers. No. The mode of thought is interconnected to an ethos, an ethic. That's the whole point of this talk and the stuff I've been doing all week. And so that's the worry. Then those people are asked to go back and teach the young at wherever, church-related and non-church-related schools. And that's becoming increasingly tougher because the graduate schools have, you know, 6, 7, 8 years crack at these people before they get their PhD, and they come out different. Yeah.
I think one thing, just bringing it up, it that frustrates me is that it's become so fragmented. I think the idea, especially I teach at the high school level, and we think, well, you only teach math in math class, you only teach English in English class, you only teach history in history class. Well, they're also interconnected. Mm-hmm. And I also teach American Lit. And because I'm in a public school, you know, religion, really, you have to be very almost tiptoe when you bring that in. Well, it's very hard to talk about Emily Dickinson and not talk about her beliefs. So it's very hard to talk about the whole early American movement without bringing in religion. And so you almost give them a very fragmented approach. You know, because while you're not, history belongs somewhere else and religion belongs somewhere else and how all the other ideas that were going on belong somewhere else. And so they get such a fragmented idea of what's going on, in the same way in every other discipline. And I think that's very frustrating too. You're so limited in what you can talk about or not talk about, and it just hurts the student. And then virtue, because I think that's where they gain it, just looking at all of these things and kind of putting them together and seeing how they affect their life.
Other comments? I see we have a lot of teachers here who've sort of volunteered things they've done, difficulties they've had in attempting to instill in either their own youngsters or people in their classes, senses of humility and so forth. That's been very helpful for me, and I think some of the other teachers too. Yeah.
I'm listening to all of this and trying to relate it to my experience as a teacher of high school dropouts and the values and all of that. I hear a real almost elitist kind of thing, because this seems to apply to the graduate level and all of that, and yet we have such a large percentage of people that are falling through the cracks of education and the system. And I think maybe because their values aren't, I don't know why, but I mean, I just feel like we need to focus more as a nation and as a people on those needs somehow, and that's not being done. I think this applies to that, and I think I'm doing that, but I think we need a body of theory behind what we're doing, you know, get
Thank
it down
you for
to being practical.
There's
yeah.
such a,
yeah.
a catch-22, I don't know how many parents this past year came to me, you know, and there's all, you know, you can't teach values, you can't teach these things to our children, and then so many parents come and say, well, I don't know what to do with my kid, what do you think? Mm-hmm. You know, and I kind of laugh because I'm barely older than they are in a lot of cases, and they just don't know what to do at that point. And, you know, so they're saying, don't do anything and yet do everything. And it's hard to know where to go from that.
I think that to get to your point, you're right, it could be construed as somewhat, quote, elitist. I spoke out of my experience. I've been at higher education. I used, one of the reasons I used the Jaime Escalante story, the stand and deliver story, mm-hmm. and that he's basically working mm-hmm. with students, I gather, much like the students you work with. And that is a story about how once he changed that personal chemistry, the students among one another, and also he did a lot with the home, I mean, connecting up, signing contracts, holding people accountable and so forth, getting the parents involved. I mean, it really involved transforming a community much more than it did. And those of you who've seen, you know, challenge me if you think my reading is wrong here, but don't you think it much more involved transforming a community than it did just teaching calculus better than the next person could? Establishing a whole ethos in terms of his relationship to them and their relationship to each other and their relationship to their parents, etc. And so were you one of those who raised your hand that you saw the movie or not?
Well, I was thinking of another one. I hadn't seen that movie, but that's what happens when we have an adult in our classroom, is we're not just teaching a subject. I teach social studies and history with adults, but we're taking a life is walking in and saying, I want to make some changes here, and how do we do it? And so we're working with treatment issues, with drug addiction issues, with family issues, with family literacy, with all those needs, you know. Mm-hmm. You just have to meet all of that. And that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
And that's what's just a very sad comment on that movie. When I last heard, he has dropped out of education. Mm-hmm. He's very disillusioned with the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's very sad. He did so much good, you know, and they started setting up boundaries. You know, you're overstepping what you're supposed to be doing. You're not following the system correctly. And I think that's a very sad statement mm-hmm. about our education.
And that is my frustration with a lot of K-12 education, is that I think we must address those issues, you know, that we cannot just take our classroom.
Mm-hmm. James, you had a...
In our community, the school district, we're doing a strategic plan, kind of looking in the future, and the group that's working on it, talking to some of the members, and the toughest discussion they've had so far, where they disagreed the most, apparently, has been over this question of, is it the role of the schools to, you know, teach the subjects, or is it sort of teach life, you know, character development, and
where do you draw the line? And I don't know that we can answer that. We could have a debate in this room, but I think that it raises a fundamental question that goes beyond, it seems to me, you know, just teaching in a classroom, you know, raises the fundamental question of education for what? And so, personally, I think, you know, the role of education is to provide a person with certain skills that, depending upon their background and character and morality and whatever, and ethics, they can use a variety of ways. And I think that education is, in some respects, being over-criticized for not producing all kinds of end products, but when you look at it, the education system really has a limited impact. You know, I try and deal with so many things all at once. But I certainly think, as we're discussing it right now, it is a question you have to ponder. You know, what is our motive here? What is our scope of responsibility? Is it simply to provide them with the tools and subject, or is it beyond that?
Okay, I'll give you a brief response, and then we're going to have to close. I guess just by having the last word, you shouldn't take it as the last word on the subject. Mm-hmm. Just happens to be the last one before we have to go to Vespers, okay? I think the issue is falsely posed, frankly. Should we teach skills, subject matters, or life? I think that's a misconceived way to formulate the problem based on the notion that you can separate out in a tidy way knowledge and skills on the one hand and character formation on the other. My view is that every teacher is teaching life and shaping character when he or she teaches history, math, physics, and they do it by the manner in which they teach history, chemistry, and physics, and the manner in which they get the students to relate to them and to each other. It seems to me that in my teaching history well, that includes shaping character and teaching life if I'm teaching history well. I would say the same is true of chemistry, physics, mathematics, you name it. And therefore, the people who imagine that they can separate this by posing the question, should we teach chemistry or should we teach life, just fail to see how inwardly connected pedagogy is with character formation, regardless of the subject matter. That would be my shorthand response, but it's something we'll all have to talk about further on a different occasion. Thanks for being so attentive, and have a good evening.